before we get started, so why don't we take a few moments and center our minds? So we'll spend a few minutes doing a sitting meditation. And then might do a short meditation on why our lives are so precious. So let's get started. I think everyone here knows the posture and so forth and so on, right? Yes? We've gone through the previous classes. Okay, good. So then let's just take our meditation posture and for a few minutes concentrate on the breath, just centering our minds, letting our day fall away. So if you know how to do the 9-round breathing, you can do that to clear the stale energy in our mind stream, in our bodies. Or you can do what His Holiness the Dalai Lama has advised, which is take 3 deep breaths to do the same thing. So now we can, for a few moments, think about how rare and precious our life really is. So first of all, you know, we have been born as a human being. May not seem very, we take it for granted. But if we look around and see the countless beings and just in our physical world, the chances of us being born a human are pretty low. So we're so fortunate that we're born as a human being. It's a basic requirement. We're not born as animals who have to struggle for their food, for their survival, or constantly afraid of being eaten. Or in the hell realms, or in the God realms, where we take everything for granted and waste our time. Been born with all our mental faculties and our physical faculties that allow us to think, to contemplate, to study, to understand. There are many humans in this world who are not able to do all of those required things. We're born with an open mind. We're willing to accept teachings, willing to accept teachers. We've met the Buddha's teachings, which is very rare by itself. We've met teachers who are still practicing and teaching Lama Tsongkhapa's absolutely crystal clear words. Teachers like Geshe-la, Lama Zepa Rinpoche. In so many ways, we also have the time and the energy to come here, to come to Sunday teachings. The inclination, the interest. We've created karma in the past to have this interest today. So it's so important for us not to waste that positive karma, positive merit that we've created, but to take advantage of it right now. In the best way possible. So that we can transform our minds, liberate ourselves. Be of benefit to ourselves. Be a benefit to others. So that's the highest motivation we could have at any practice that we, or anything that we perform, any activity that we engage in. So let's rest on that understanding for a few moments. So good evening. My name is Shankar Mitra. Some of you, I think, have seen me before. Some of you may not have. I'm trying to. My far-sighted. I'm far nearsighted, so people in the far are kind of hazy. I can't see you very well. So this class is establishing a daily practice. So. I think this is, I don't know what order, we do it in a slightly different order than the normally, the whatever, the FPMT prescribed order. So I think that you guys have gone through, let's see, through Ram Lamrim, so that would be spiritual teacher, through precious human rebirth, through death and impermanence, through refuge, through the 12 links, you know, of the of cause, karma, cause and effect, right? Right. So how to meditation? Which one's that? Okay. But in any case, so those are the, so you guys have all gone through that. Maybe some of you haven't, which is okay. Maybe you've missed some, which is fine too. So this next 5 weeks, I think it is, are basically to, you know, so far the classes, you know, they give you a lot of information, right? And it's not really clear how to structure it into practice, you know, put it into practice. So this is what the next 5 weeks is about, is to, you know, what one does in you know, how one structures a meditation, how one establishes a daily practice, you know, how to have a daily practice, what are the things that work, what are the things that don't, what is the structure of a meditation session, because there's actually a particular structure, you know, there's a sequence of things that one does, and that's actually true in just about every puja that you go to, like when you do the medicine Buddha puja that, you know, that we might have tomorrow or day after. There's actually the same order of things that happen. So that structure, how to structure a meditation session, and, you know, what obstacles might come up, and how, what are the antidotes for them, you know. So those are the types of things that we cover here. So hopefully it will, you know, encourage you to have a daily practice if you don't have one already. And if you have one, then at least, you know, hopefully it will make it clearer and make it more kind of, you know, kind of more rounded, right? So you know how to, because, you know, it's not like one size fits all, right? Each of us has his or her own inclinations and interests, and some things grab us more than others, you know? So we kind of like pick and choose different things, but, you know, you kind of mold it into your own, right? But you have to an understanding of the overall whole picture to kind of know how to mold it, right? So hopefully this class will give that to you. But at least if, you know, at least at the minimum, hopefully it will spur you to have a daily practice, right? So that's the main goal. One quick logistical thing. I won't be here next week, but Robbie will be. So you all know Robbie. So he will sub for me next week. I'll be out of town next week. So, but we'll still have the class. I'm trying to look at my cheat sheet and see what I thought about. I lost my notes from the previous time I, you know, did this class. So I had to redo it. Right. Actually, the other thing is also what to do. What they say in the Lam Rim text, what they say is what to do in between sessions, which basically means for us householders who are not monks and nuns, you know, doing four sessions or six sessions a day, you know. For us, in between session basically means, you know, like the whole day, essentially, right? So, you know, because we may do one session, you know, I do a session in the morning, and so I do the next session, well, one session in the evening. So in between, there's a good 18 hours, whatever it is, you know, 14 hours, you know, something like that, right? So what to do in between, which is very important. So that's probably the most important part. So this module is kind of like the rubber hits the road. You know, we have all this information. How do we kind of help us transform our minds, right? Because that's what the goal of the entire Dharma is, right? So, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, when we study Buddhism, you know, for a lot of us, it's an academic endeavor, right? I mean, for me, it was an academic endeavor for quite a while. You know, I read all these books and I went to all these teachings, but, you know, then when I came home, I really didn't do all that much with it, you know? But I read the books, and I kind of thought, oh, that's interesting, that makes sense, you know. But that was a limit of it, right? And, you know, one of the dangers, they say, is that we can become insensitive to the Dharma. And what that means is that, you know, we read all this information, we read all these things for information, for knowledge. You know, it goes into our heads, But then what happens is that if we are not trying to put it into practice, you know, it makes sense to us, but there's a difference between it making sense and it changing our minds, right? You know, it goes in here, but doesn't go in here, you know? So, the insensitivity is that our mind becomes so full, our brain becomes so full of information that when we, you know, and it's full of information, but what happens is when we go to a teaching next time around, we'll probably have thoughts like, you know, well, I've heard this already, you know, I know this already, why am I here? Or how is this, you know, this is, you know, this thousand times they've said the same thing, right? And we become, you know, we lose the receptiveness, right? Of it opening our hearts. And you know, somebody, I don't know, I can't remember who it was. Somebody said that, you know, the goal of Dharma, the goal of spiritual practice in general, not just Buddhism, I think for any tradition, is for it ultimately to change the way we are. Right? I mean, spiritual practice, I think by definition, is that it has to change the spirit, right? I mean, I guess that's where it comes from, the spirit. So, you know, that's a different lingo than Buddhism, but still, it's very, you know, that is what it is, right? It has to change our spirit. And if it doesn't, you know, affect our spirit, then it's not really spiritual practice, right? I mean, there are many scholars, great scholars, right, with PhDs and great translators who know every, you know, they know every in and out and the detail, you know, of Buddhist thought, the most esoteric, you know, views of emptiness and so forth and so on. But their lives are full of suffering. Why is that, right? It's because they are, again, full of information. They know the information, but they have not let the information touch their hearts, right? I think that's the insensitivity, or that's the danger that they say. And that's why it's important, before we get so full of information, to try to put it into practice. Because once we try to put it into practice, through a meditation, you know, through a daily meditation practice, on the cushion and then knowing what to do off the cushion and things like that, you know, we grow internally, you know, we grow. I guess, you know, my teacher says, you know, it just softens your heart. Right? It softens our hearts. And so we are able to, you know, we see it in a different light. It's not just information, right? When we read something, when we meditate on Precious Human Rebirth, or, you know, because Precious Human Rebirth, let's take that, you know, we just did that, right? I mean, it's clear, right? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, well, actually, it's not necessarily clear. I mean, I took the fact that I'm born a human. I mean, I never really thought about it, right? I mean, who thinks about it? Right? I mean, I took it for granted. I really, before I, you know, I actually did this, when I was starting, and I remember doing this calculation, you know, like, actually, I mean, if you think about it, there's 6 billion people in the world, you know. So that's a pretty small number when you think about it. There's probably 6 billion beings, just animal kingdom, right? In the animal realm, there's probably 6 billion within a 1 square mile here. Right? Maybe not even that. Maybe less than that, right? So there's quadrillions of beings probably on this planet, maybe more, right? So 6 billion is a pretty darn small number out of them, right? And then when you start hacking it away, you know, how many people have all the mental and physical faculties, how many are, you know, have met the Dharma, how many among them have the time and the effort, because most people out of the 6 billion are trying to put food on the table, right? So they don't have time and leisure like we do, right? So you cut it down. It's a really small number, in the tens of millions, maybe, right? And then, of course, now they say that, you know, in the Milky Way galaxy, just in our galaxy, there's 17 billion, they estimate, 17 billion planets that have a habitable atmosphere, or they believe are habitable, right? That's what I read 2 weeks ago, right? So they believe that, you know, the 17 billion planets that have that are possibly habitable, right? And we are just one of them. So there's six, so there's a few tens of millions of people on this planet who have all the luxuries and leisure, and you know, the 8 leisures and the 10 opportunities, right, that you guys went over. So, you know, so if you think about how many other beings there might be on these other planets, even if there are only 10 out of the 17 billion that are truly populated, right, I mean, that's still a huge number again, right? So, you know, it's, and, you know, so then they use a turtle analogy, you know, the turtle with the, yolk on the top of the ocean, and, you know, it comes up for air once every 100 years, and so forth and so on, right? So that's the kind of analogy they use. But, I mean, you know, it's, when you think about it, it is so amazingly rare to have this life that we have. And so if we, you know, so first of all, we may not think about it. We take it for granted. But even when we think about it, it's just information. We say, okay, yeah, that's interesting, right? But then, you know, that's still up here, right? I mean, we understand, okay, yeah, that's interesting. I get that, right? I mean, okay, I'll take that, right? So it's still up here. But it doesn't change the way we really act, right? Because if it really went into our hearts, then we would never, ever question why our life, you know, why is our life, you know, like sometimes we feel like our life isn't meaningful, right? Geshe-la talks about it, right? People come up to him and they say, you know, my life isn't meaningful. You know, I have, you know, decent family, decent job, decent house, decent everything else, but my life isn't meaningful, right? And he's like, what? You know? And so that's what he talks about, is that, you know, and this says in the text, right? And if you go to a teacher for advice, they'll say, you know, if you feel that your life isn't meaningful, it means that you have not realized precious human rebirth. That's the basic requirement, right? So that's the kind of thing. That's why it's important to have a meditation practice, is because, you know, if we are able to internalize how our life is truly precious, then, oh, there's so many things that fall away. There's so many problems that fall away. You know, and then, of course, there's death and impermanence, which is yet another thing, right? I mean, if we really truly realize death and impermanence, we would live every moment as if it were our last, right? I mean, people who go through sudden near-death experiences, you know, they say, you know, they come out of it and they say, okay, you know, they're changed, right? In a way, they're changed, right? Because they then look at it, you know, they look at their lives differently, right? Now, if we truly realize death and impermanence through our meditation practice, we don't have to go through an accident or a near-death experience. You know, it can change our lives just through the practice, right? So that's why it's, you know, ultimately the Dharma is about changing our minds, because that's where our all our problems lies. I mean, you know, all our problems lies in our minds. It's not created externally. And so if we want to solve our problems, we have to find a way to tame our minds. And the Dharma basically are the set of tools to tame our minds. And if we really want to solve our problems, then the only way is to put the Dharma teachings into practice. Right? And the only way to put it into practice is to have a daily practice, because it's on the cushion, the work we do on the cushion, that conditions our minds for the rest of the day, right? Because when we're in the middle of turmoil, we're not going to suddenly remember, oh yeah, precious human rebirth, right? So what we do on the cushion is basically remind ourselves every day, right, that this life is precious, you know, so forth and so on, right? So that when we go through our day, well, sometimes we're in a different frame of mind, right? The same problems might appear, but we don't react to it the same way, right? So that's when we know it's starting to change our minds, right? We're more willing to let go. We don't flip off the guy, you know, he cuts us off or whatever it is, right? So that's when we know it's, you know, so, you know, maybe in the best case, you know, it will help us not react or help us respond in constructive ways or, you know, et cetera, right? But even if we're not able to do that, sometimes what happens is even if we do react, we do remember, right? I mean, the moment after that, we may remember what it's about, right? That there is another. I mean, it may not stop us from reacting, but it does. It's better than just going off totally, right? So what we do on the, that's why it's so important to have a practice on the cushion, because that is what will help us when we're off the cushion, the in-between session part, right? Which is pretty much most of our lives, is off the cushion. I'm sure you all know this, so I'm not giving you some, you know, great epiphany here or whatever, great, you know, but I think, you know, it's, I kind of started this module with that spiel because, you know, for me, it took quite a long time to really get it. You know, because we always wait till tomorrow, you know, I'll do it tomorrow or I'll do it next week. And, well, next week may not come. Tomorrow may not come either. So that's one problem with that, you know. And the second problem is that there's always, you know, there's demands in our time, right? So we have to kind of prioritize it in such a way that, you know, we make that time. You know, Geshe-la says this. I think he's told me once. He said, you know, don't tell me you don't have time. He said, don't tell me you don't have time. He said, you've made certain priorities about your time, right? We all have 24 hours in a day, right? I mean, you know, each of us has exactly the same amount of time. It's just that we have made different priorities about our time, right? Which is not, you know, neither bad nor good, right? He's just, you know, it's just a statement, right? So if we want to make the time, we have the time. Maybe we have to drop something else. And sometimes, you know, it's a matter of us having that understanding to decide what's more important, right? You know, and to as you know, as the teachers would say, you know, the practice that we do on the cushion is not just for this life, actually, either, right? I mean, everything else that we do with our time is for this life. What we do on the cushion is for every other life after this, and this life certainly, but for every other life after this. So, in a way, you probably could find nothing more important. So like that. And if, you know, and if we do a daily practice and are able to gain those realizations, right, of precious human life, of death and impermanence, of karma, of... Is it clear what I mean by realizations? You know, to get a realization of precious human rebirth or karma or death and impermanence? Yeah? Okay, well, maybe I'll... So, when they say realization, it basically means that it's an unshakable belief, unshakable understanding, right? It becomes like almost instinctual understanding of something, right? Of that idea. So that our life essentially becomes suffused by it, right? We live it, right? And nobody can, you know, shake us from that understanding, right? I mean, so often we have a shallow understanding of something and somebody comes along and makes a pretty darn good argument against that, right? And we say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe he's right after all, right? But when we have a realization, it means that, you know, we know it. You know, we can't be shaken from it. And so what that means for something like Precious Human Rebirth is that, well, I mean, nobody was going to come and tell you that you're going to, well, maybe nowadays they do say something, you know, they're like all these people trying to live forever. But in any case, at least so far, I don't know, nobody's convinced me that I'm going to live forever. So, you know, so that's an easy one, right? So that can't be shaken, if you will. But the realization part there is that to really live as if this life is truly rare and precious, right? That's the realization part, right? Where, you know, when somebody's, you know, says, you know, talks about this human life, you immediately have, they say, you know, you have this, like, in your heart, you just become, oh, wow, you know? Or what, you know, to get a realization of a spiritual teacher, of how, you know, of his kindness, his qualities, and so forth and so on, right? You know, they say, you know, tears come down your eyes, you know, so but when you think about your teacher, right? So that's like the realization, right? So when we have with the practice, when we have realizations like that, then there is no gap between what the Dharma teaches and what we practice, right? Because in our ordinary minds today, there's a big gap, right? We understand what the Dharma teaches, but when we put it into practice, there's a big gap, right? And that's the point, is to basically narrow that gap until there is no gap. And when there's no gap, of course, that's the realization. But, you know, this is the practice that we're all engaged in, right? If you're here, I'm assuming that you're interested, and that's why you're here, right? And that's the only way that, you know, that we can, it doesn't matter which tradition we belong to, right? That's the only way we can change the way we are. Right, or liberate ourselves, if you will, right, is to do these practices that get us there, right? And it's important to have, you know, a spiritual goal, right? I mean, we, you know, in our ordinary lives, in our mundane lives, like they say, you know, we have goals, right? We want to get this promotion, or we want to be so-and-so, or, you know, we want to take this trip, you know, next year, so I have to save up for it, you know, every month this much so I can, you know, pay for it next year. You know, we have all these goals, right? But we have goals for our kids. We have goals for our families. We have goals, you know, all these things, right? But, you know, in Dharma practice is no different, right? We have to have spiritual goals. You know, what is it that we want to do in this life? Basic minimum, right? You know, like what is it that we want to do at the minimum, basic minimum in this life? And it doesn't have to, you know, I mean, you know, chances are we're not going to be enlightened in this lifetime. Chances are, right? So, if we can't make, what can we do, and how do we get there, right? And each of us has to make that decision by ourselves. But it's important to have a goal. You know, and that goal, and that might take decades, right? But we have, but every day when we do something, how are we working towards that goal? And so I think that's, you know, those kinds of things we need to do to kind of propel ourselves, right, to keep the fire underneath us, to know when we're making progress, you know, so we know if, you know, a couple of years down the line, you know, you look back and you say, okay, well, you know, if this happened to me a couple of years ago, I probably would have done I'm doing a much better job of it now than I would have been. You know, so that means that I'm making progress, right? We can benchmark ourselves, right? But if we don't have goals, then we're kind of just wandering, and we kind of lose ourselves. So that's the other reason, you know, that goals actually help us with the daily practice as well, because we can kind of see how all of this ties in to where we're trying to go. So what we'll do is so before I go further, there are, you know, you have those the reading material, right? And the reading material, I was looking at it, and if you could read the first three readings, which are, the first two are just pretty short, and the third one is about precious human rebirth, actually. So that would, you know, so once we leave today, what would be wonderful is if you could set aside maybe, I don't know, you can pick, but, you know, maybe 15 minutes, right, during the day. If you want to make it longer, that's fine too. But if you just set aside 15 minutes during the day, this is kind of homework, I guess. And you know, do a meditation on precious human rebirth. And the reason we choose precious human rebirth is because it is the kind of the basic, the first thing one really has to internalize. And so, and if you've been doing it, wonderful. Maybe you can just go it a little bit deeper. Maybe you can make it a little bit longer, you know, and go in a little bit deeper. You can get various texts, you know. So what one can do is, actually, maybe I'll talk about this in a little bit later, after I discuss today. So, up to and including number three, which I think is the precious human rebirth. What's the number three? Making life meaningful. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. Yeah. The first three. Whatever the first three are, I know that was what I wanted. So what you can do is, you know, you can read, you know, we can read the Making Life Meaningful reading, that teaching. And, you know, and then, you know, every morning you can pick, you know, you can just pick, like, you know, a few paragraphs or whatever it is, and see how it kind of, you know, and reflect on it, right? That's the kind of the way that we normally do these meditations. But the other thing one can also do is, if you know, well, you've gone through the classes, so you know the 8 freedoms and the 10 opportunities, right? And they have it in the Lamrim texts. They have it in various other commentaries on the Lamrim. So you can basically do a review meditation, for example, where you kind of go through it, right? And so you kind of, like as I did with today, you kind of go through the points. You know, I didn't go through all the points, but I just went through some of the points. But you go through all the points, and then you try to gain, you know, you try to say, oh, okay, that does make, you know, like you go like, wow, okay, that's true. You know, it is really precious, right? And you get this feeling, right? You try, what you're trying to do is get this feeling that, yeah, wow, that is true, you know? And you, when you get that feeling, what you do is, so that's the analytical part, and then you do this concentration, you know, the single-pointed concentration meditation on that feeling, right? So you kind of, this is how Lam Rim meditation is supposed to happen, by the way, right? So you kind of go through the points, and you get this understanding, just, you know, you're sitting there going, okay, wow, you know, wow, that's true. And then you stay there on that feeling that you have of, wow, that's true, as long as you can. Single point, you know, not thinking about anything else, not thinking about the points anymore, but just that feeling, wow, that's true. And you just stay on that. And then when you say, well, maybe 30 seconds later, like, okay, my mind is kind of, you know, going away and thinking about the points maybe, or maybe what I have to do tomorrow, all this stuff, right? Then you go through, kind of remind yourself on the points again and go, oh, wow, that's true. And you go again, right? And every time we do this, our minds, you know, we can do it a little bit longer, right? Stay on it a little bit longer. And that's what we're trying to do. Because what happens is, if we can stay on it longer and, you know, longer, and we do it every day, and you can keep that feeling, that's how it leads to realizations. So, Lam Rim meditations are always supposed to be, you do the analytical meditation, you do the, you know, you go through the points, and you kind of persuading yourself, right? I'm persuading myself that this is really true, right? And you kind of, you think about the points and you try to attack it from both angles. You don't just say, well, okay, this is true because, you know, Lama Tsongkhapa says it's true, or the Buddha says, you know, you kind of try to find, you know, you can, okay, well, no, you know, am I, you know, maybe I can live forever, you know, why does this life have to end, you know, so forth and so on. So you kind of like start at, you kind of like, you know, debate yourself, right? And hopefully you come to the same conclusion as Lama Tsongkhapa and the Buddha did. And when you come to that conclusion, that's when you realize, okay, well, that is true, right? And once you get that, wow, that's true feeling, then you kind of sit on it, stay on it, right? And that's the single-pointed concentration part. And so when you hear Geshe La talking about calm-abiding meditations, you know, and calm-abiding meditation is nothing other than single-pointed concentration, except that calm-abiding is meditation is a practice so that we can stay on the object, which is, wow, that's true, that's the object in our case, for as long as we want. Because if we can do that, it just happens, you know, realizations happen so fast. So that's why they always are harping on calm abiding meditations, is because if we are able to use a tool of calm abiding meditation, all this other stuff becomes just much, much easier. You know, our minds are, it's much, our minds become much more pliable. Anyway, let's not go there. I tend to kind of diverge and can't find my way back. But yeah, so that's the single, you know, so that's how Lam Rim meditations, or meditations in general, are supposed to happen on top, you know, to gain realizations. So if you can do that, you know, for 15 minutes or however long you can manage, you know, and see how it works, right? So that's the kind of the easy way to start a daily practice before, you know, you have to do like, you know, things, you know, six preparatory practices and all that stuff that we'll talk about. So, So now that's the basic introduction stuff, right? So now, how to kind of overall in our day, what is, you know, how to structure from a spiritual standpoint, how to structure our day, right? And Lama Zopa Rinpoche had some wonderful advice for all his students about how, you know, what to do, right? So that we are always kind of in the Dharma. Our minds are always in the Dharma, no matter what we're doing, whether at work or, you know, at home or, you know, et cetera. So what we do is, he said, you know, the minute you wake up, the first thing, you know, you haven't even gotten out of bed yet, maybe. Right? You haven't even gotten coffee yet. So you just kind of, you kind of open your eyes and you say, wow, I'm still alive. Right? So again, something we take for granted. Again, I did this calculation, you know. It's every 3 seconds there's someone dying in this world. Okay? I mean, I did, you know, if you look up, you know, how many people die per year in the world or day or whatever it is, and you take out, you know, do the calculation, it comes to about every 3 seconds or 4 seconds, somebody's dying in this world. So if we've lasted 8 hours sleeping and haven't died yet, that's pretty darn good, right, that we weren't one of those people. So what Lama Zopa says, okay, is you wake up and you say, wow, how wonderful that I have another day, you know? And so you're already thinking precious human rebirth, I mean, in some form or fashion, right? Thinking, wow, you know, I have another day. May I, you know, how may I make the best of this day by being of most benefit to everyone, to benefit to myself, certainly, right? Because if we can't benefit ourselves, we can't benefit others. That's a given, right? So may I be of most benefit, not just to myself, but to everyone around me, whoever I come into contact with today, right? So, you know, so that's our waking up motivation, right? We set the motivation for the whole day. You know, in general, we always, if you've noticed, every practice, we set a motivation, right? You know, for example, you know, when the Sunday morning prayers, right? Our Sunday morning teachings, Geshe-la's teachings, right? You do the Tathagata Om Mani Mani Mune Mune, you know, the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra, and then we do the four immeasurables, right? That's the motivation prayer, right? And so, and as when we, you know, when we do refuge prayers and so forth and so on, they're all motivation prayers, right? May I, you know, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha by my virtuous actions of giving and so on. May I be of benefit, may I be enlightened. And become enlightened for the benefit of all beings, right? So that's the motivation, right? So like that, our day starts with a motivation. So he's saying, you know, you wake up, you think how wonderful it is, I have another day. May I be of most benefit, right? So that, again, our life becomes meaningful that way. So in that one motivation, we're thinking of, you know, precious human rebirth. We're thinking of how to make our lives meaningful. We're thinking about bodhicitta, right? Great compassion. Because we think about benefiting others, right? You know, you can think of all kinds, you know, the karma that I've created, you know, to be around another day, right? So then you can bring in karma, right? You know, there's, you know, I mean, that one motivation, you can bring the entire Dharma into it. You know, if you are able, you know, if you've been studying the Lamrim and things like that, right? So that's the first thing, right? And then when we do our practices, he says to, you know, if you're able to find the time, then it's really helpful or beneficial, certainly, to do the refuge prayer, right? And the reason is, you know, the refuge prayer has a lot of power. I mean, it's a very short, well, I mean, there are long refuge prayers too, but the ones that we do is very short. But it has an incredible power. And the reason is that, you know, it's not just, Because so often we are, you know, we like to feel, think that we're independent, and we like to think that we, you know, we can control everything, right? And the refuge prayer is exactly the opposite. It basically says that, you know, I don't know all that much, right? And I need help. You know, I'm in this, I'm in this turmoil, right? Birth, old age, sickness, and death. That's the basic stuff. And then there's all the stuff in between, right? And I don't have the answers. And please help me, right? And so, it's again, it's a way to soften our hearts, right? Because we're open to more than just ourselves trying to grab onto the next thing, right? We're basically saying, please help me, Buddhas, right? That, you know, bless me, send me the blessings, that I may be a better, you know, be able to help myself, help others, right? And so it's a prayer that has, because of that, you know, it's like they say that, you know, all of us have the seed of the Buddhahood, right? Buddha nature, right? All of us has that. Each of us has that seed. Even the animals, even the every being has that seed. But just like any seed, for it to grow into a plant and to flower, right? You have to till the soil. You have to put fertilizer in it, right? You have to make, you know, weed it, weed the ground. You know, the rain, you know, it has to be in some amount of sun. There has to be some water, you know, rain. All these things, right? For it to germinate, you know, for that seed, the potential is there, but for that seed to germinate and to grow into something beautiful, all these conditions have to come into play, right? And the refuge prayer is like that because, well, I mean, all these things are like that. I mean, all the, you know, but the refuge prayer basically is the sun and the rain and, you know, the blessings, right? So that, you know, because without the blessings, it's very hard to make progress. Because, again, it becomes just information. You know, again, we just have information in our mind. It doesn't touch our hearts. For that seed in our hearts to germinate, we need all the blessings from the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and our teachers and so forth and so on. And so that's where why the Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he asks, you know, people to do the refuge prayer and ask for help, right? And if you have a teacher, then you ask for help from your teacher and so forth. You know, you see the Buddhas as inseparable from your teacher. That's number one, right? So then, and you ask for help from your teacher. And then to start the day, again, if you have time, but if you don't, you know, actually, the other thing is that if you start doing these practices, actually, they go really fast because you can I do some of these practices when I'm having my cup of coffee, right? So instead of spacing out and half drowsy while I'm doing, I just do my prayers, right? Because I know them by heart, right? So if you do them long enough, it's not even a couple of months, really, you have them memorized. And so you can do the 35 Buddhas, you know, for example, you know, I'll talk about this. So the other thing Lama Zopa Rinpoche says is that to start your morning, you know, with the refuge prayer and with the 35 Buddha practice, right? I don't know. Do you guys know the 35, when I say the 35 Buddhas, you can practice? So it's a... it's basically a purification practice. And the 35 Buddhas were these, each of the Buddhas made a vow that people who make prayers to them that they will help them purify whatever karma it is that they are essentially asking for, trying to purify, right? So, some Buddhas, and each Buddha has, there's a particular karma, if you will, that they will help you purify, right? So, so the 35 Buddhas practice, it's basically, at night you do the confessional practice. I guess the 35 Buddhas is also a confessional practice. But basically it's about all the negative imprints that I've created over countless lives. Because that is our minds today is the result of the impurities we've created in all those countless lives, right? So what we're trying to do is remove the causes or purify the causes of purify all those negative imprints so that they don't ripen in future lives, right? So that's what we're trying to do. And so if we start the day, we start the day with that practice, So a lot of people will do these. And so it's always accompanied by, you do these prostrations to the 35 Buddhas. It's also a very good exercise, by the way. It's really good exercise because I'll tell you that, when I used to do, I can't do them nowadays because I have some back trouble. I can't do them in the morning, but later on in the day I can do it, but in the morning I can't do it. And so, when I used to do them, for half an hour, I measured my heart rate. It was at 140, 150, it's really good aerobic exercise. So if you want to, instead of going on a treadmill, you can do this a few times a day, a week, it's pretty darn good. So you can do prostration, you can do the prostrations. If you're not able to do prostrations, you can visualize prostrations. That's how I do it now, So you visualize that you're prostrating to the Buddhas, right? So I can do it with my cup of coffee now because I have it memorized, right? So I can do the whole thing while I'm doing, So there are other, so that's one of the things he says. And then you do the practice that we're gonna go over in this class. We'll do a Shakyamuni Buddha a meditation practice. It's called Shakyamuni Buddha Guru Yoga, and it's the official one, if you will, the one that. That is published by FPM. Lama Zopa Rinpoche has one that's published through the FPMT. And that you can get in a booklet form, or an e-book form, or whatever. It's like a couple of bucks, $2, $3 or something. And there's a Shakyamuni Buddha Guru Yoga. And I don't know if I'll use that one or not, or there's a shortened version that Venerable Rene Fuchsia uses, which is kind of a chantable. So I find that really nice, So actually he used it. I don't know, those of you who were here for his teaching like a month or so ago, he did but he didn't chant it, which I don't know. I think he's a little self-conscious about chanting it. So he didn't chant it, but it's chantable. And I know the tune, so we can try to do that. It's nice. So that's what the next three or four sessions is about, is how to do that, what is the order, that's the Guru Yoga practice, right? How to do it. So after the prostration 35 Buddhas, we do the Guru Yoga practice, and then we do a Lam Rim meditation, right? So the Guru Yoga practice is basically asking the Buddha again for blessings and to open our mind up, open our hearts, right? So that we can achieve our spiritual goals. And so forth and so on. And so after the Guru Yoga practice, we do a meditation on the Lam Rim, right? So whatever topic that you're studying, whether in this class, I mean, whether it as part of discovering Buddhism, you know, so if you were, let's say, let's say you were doing refuge in discovering Buddhism, the topic on refuge, and you were already had a, you know, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha Guru Yoga practice, right? So what you do is you do all these things, you would sit out on the cushion, you would do the Guru Yoga, Shakyamuni Buddha Guru Yoga practice, and you'd stop, and we'll talk about where to stop and do the meditation, and you'd stop, and then you'd kind of go through the analytical meditation process about refuge, right? You think about all the points, you know, fear and faith and all this, you know, all those points that engender refuge. And then when you get to the place where you say, oh, wow, you know, only the Buddhists can help, you know, and you have this true sense of refuge, and you then do the single point of meditation on that feeling, as we talked about, and you keep doing it back over and over again, you know, you alternate analytical meditation and single pointed like that. And then you finish the practice. Yeah.
Can you explain what the difference between a chant and a mantra?
Oh, yeah. Well, a mantra is basically usually something in Sanskrit or Tibetan, right? So, you know, if you have the medicine Buddha mantra prayer, you know, Om Bekanze, short one, Om Bekanze Bekanze Mahabekanze Ranja Samudgata Soha. So that's the medicine Buddha or the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra, which is, you know, Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. So, you know, it's essentially a prayer really shrunken to like a few syllables, right? So that's the mantra. And the reason we have the mantras is, oh, I guess I'm digressing again, but I'll say it. But the reason we have the mantras, most of the things we do is in English, but some few things we still say it in Tibetan or in Sanskrit. And the reason is, they say, is because so many great masters, you know, over the last, if it's in Sanskrit, 2,500 years, and if it's in Tibetan, over the last 1,000 years, right, have basically chanted the exact same mantras, that have the syllables themselves have an energy, a power to them. And so if in tantric practice, for example, you know, the mantras bring up certain energies that you're trying to cultivate and so forth and so on, right? So those mantras are usually in Sanskrit and Tibetan. And then you have prayers that we read. Most prayers we actually read. But a lot of prayers, there's a tune to them, you know. So, you know, I do a Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga practice, which is like the Shakyamuni Buddha practice every day. And that has a tune, you know. So it kind of, when you have a tune, you kind of like, you don't have to so much think about the word. Because usually if you're reading, your mind is just engaged in reading the words. You're not really feeling it, right? But if you have a chant, you don't have to read it because our minds automatically just memorize it really fast, right? It's like a song, right? I mean, how easy is it to memorize, you know, to remember a song, right? And so we don't have to think about the words anymore. Whenever we're chanting, it's our minds automatically just know, you know, they already feel, right? And so that's why chantable prayers, have so much power. I don't know. Did I answer your question? Yes? Oh, good. Okay. So we do the, you know, whatever Guru Yoga practice we're doing. You know, sometimes, you know, you can do a, if you're doing a Thara practice, you can do a Thara practice. If you're doing a medicine Buddha practice, you can do a medicine Buddha practice. If you're doing Shakyamuni Buddha practice, you can do Shakyamuni, you know, whatever it is. And then you can, you know, after, you know, we'll talk about where to stop, and you can do a Lam Rim meditate, you know, because we're also usually studying, if you're in discovering Buddhism, or if you graduate and, you know, you're continuing the Dharma, you're still studying the Lam Rim. In some form or fashion, because so you then think about, you know, you would do an analytical meditation, or you do a meditation on that Lam Rim topic, like a refuge, like we talked about, etc. Right at the end of the Guru Yoga. So that's kind of usually in the morning. It's best to do it in the morning because our minds are fresh. We haven't gotten totally wrapped up in the day's events and so forth and so on, you know. if you're able to get up early, that's the best time to do it. Some people are better at night. You know, it's up to you. You know yourself. And so you go through, you know, and so during the day, you know, we'll talk about this, how to kind of remind ourselves. But at the end of the day, what do? Right? So at the end of the day, there is, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, advises to do a short practice and do the Vajrasattva confessional practice, right? So the Vajrasattva Buddha, I don't think I see a Vajrasattva here. Anyway, so basically, you know, he basically helps. So what we do is we think through our day, and we think about everything that happened, how we reacted, whether with body, whether with speech, or with thoughts. Because most of us aren't, you know, I mean, there's the, you know, the negative actions, you know, the three of body, the four of speech, and the three of mind, right? And so most of us in this room, I expect, are not lying. Although it's hard not to lie, actually, during your day. If you're at work, especially, it's very hard not to lie. I mean, I don't know if you've discovered that or not, but I discovered that early on. Like, you know, like you can't say, I'm going to take the day off because I'm not feeling well. If you're not feeling well, you know, you can't do that anymore, right? So it's interesting. So anyway, so most of us, though, most of the time, we're not lying, we're not stealing, and we're not committing sexual misconduct, right? So most of us in this room are probably not in those, you know, but when you think about speech and mind, especially mind, if you think through the day, it's amazing. We don't even remember. I don't remember most of the things that I'm doing during the day, actually. You know, so when I'm thinking about it at night, you know, it's like a blur. You know, I don't even remember what happened. Right? Maybe a couple of things I'll remember, but that's about it. But we still try to basically say, you know, whatever it is that we did, right? You know, we bring Vajrasattva, Guru Vajrasattva, and we think through our day. We say, I'm really sorry that I did X, Y, and Z, right? In this way, right? And we try to, you know, there's a practice with the, you know, with great regret. You know, we rely on the Buddhas, right? We have great regret, right? We do the practice to remedy, right? Whatever we have, you know, negative imprints we've created, right? And then we resolve not to do it again. But rather because that's a resolution most likely we're not going to be able to keep. But at least not to do it for some length of time that is appropriate, right? If it's something that we do all the time, then maybe we resolve not to do it for a day, you know, or a few hours maybe, I don't know. If it's something that we don't do very often, then we resolve not to do it for a couple of weeks, a month maybe, whatever it is, right? Like that. But we bring up great regret and this resolution, right? That I'm going to try to do a better job next time, right? And so that's a confession, because it's important to just, Geshe Lo says that, you know, at least what you want to do is not have the karma grow. I mean, if you've gone through the karma class, right? Remember, one of the things about karma is that it's definite, you know, there's those points about karma, right? Karma is definite, and karma grows, right? There are four points on karma, right? The second was, first is karma is definite, the second is karma grows, right? So it's like a tree, like that the seed just grows. And so over a small act that we do, a negative act that we do today, can grow over a lifetime into something gigantic, right? And that's a good thing, actually, because that's true for positive karma. Any little thing that we do, just generosity, just giving a couple of, you know, dollars to somebody or bringing a cup of coffee to somebody, right? That also grows, which is a good thing. But if we do something negative, we try to purify it that day so that it cannot grow, right? So So Geshe, you know, so we can talk more about the Vajrasattva practice later on, but that's something. If you know about the Vajrasattva practice, then, you know, at least we can do that little bit. Right? And so the power of it is that we don't hold it in our, you know, because a lot of time we tend to beat ourselves up over things that we've done. And so this allows us, gives us a little bit of space to just let go and just say, well, you know, I'm human. You know, I'm still working on myself. I need, you know, and so, you know, I didn't do a great job in this particular instance, but, you know, I'll try to do a better job tomorrow and just leave it at that, right? And so that's one thing. So it helps us let go. And the second thing is, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, is when you go to bed, if you've done the confession practice, then you can say, well, I've taken care of everything. If this is the last night that I have, then everything's taken care of. Right? There's a story about this Tibetan Lama who used to, every night, you know, he would basically just, you know, he'd only had a couple of books or something, but he would take his books and he would put it on one place, and he would take his slippers that he had and put it in the other place, and then he would have everything arranged and neat, right? And he would, you know, and he would go and he would put his, you know, and go in, and then he would go to sleep, because then if he didn't wake up the next morning, people didn't have to go arrange everything, right? I mean, you know, fix it, you know, he with everything is one place, you know, all they had to do was take his body out and take his stuff out, and that would be, you know, they can reuse the room fast, right? Well, I'm making that part up, but still, like that, you know. So it's that awareness, right? And that's what Lama Zopa Rinpoche, what Rinpoche is saying is that, you know, we have to have this awareness, you know, so that when we go to sleep, we're thinking, okay, this might be my last night. And so next morning when you wake up, you're like, wow, cool. You know, I have another day. Holy smoke, that wasn't my last night, you know. So, So that's the kind of structure to the day. Normally I do this later on in the class, but decided to do it early. But so that's kind of structure. You know, we start with the, you know, think in the, we wake up in the morning, we think about, you know, precious human rebirth, et cetera, and we do the, you know, and then get a cup of coffee, and then we come back and we do, you know, do the refuge and the 35 Buddhas if we can. We do our guru, you know, the meditation practice. And then we go through our day, and then at night we do our confession practice. You know, we've you know, taken care of everything. And the other thing that one of my teachers said, not Rinpoche, one of my teachers said was that as you're going to sleep, if you have a particular attraction to a holy being, bring up that image as you're trying to go to, as you're going to sleep. So that, like for example, you know, if Thara is your practice and you have a great attraction to Thara, or you know, if you're doing practices, Lama Tsongkhapa or whatever, and you can visualize, you know, you just bring up that image in your mind as you're going to sleep, and just hold that image as long as you can as you're going to sleep. And the reason is that what we want to do is have that image ingrained in our minds, so that when death really comes, because sleep is basically, you know, if you study, you'll see that sleep is actually the same process as death, except it's sort of slightly reverse. So in any case, so sleep is very close to actually the process of death. And so if we're doing it during our sleep, when death really comes, we can die with a positive mind. We can bring that image, and we can have a positive mind at death, which is probably the most important determining factor for what our next life is going to be. they say that, you know, a positive mind at death actually governs. If you have a positive mind at death, that has a huge impact, probably the biggest impact on what our next life is going to be. Because that mind actually is what goes into the bardo and so forth and so on, etc. And we decide to choose what our next life is going to be. So a positive mind at death is critical. But the problem at death is our mind is in such great fear most of the time. Actually, all the time, even if our death is really fast, like if you have a traffic accident, for example, there's still that moment where our mind is in great fear. And so you know, we don't want fear to be the last thing as we die. And so if we're able to practice while we're alive to have this image, this holy image in our minds, then when death comes, chances are we're going to be able to bring that image to our minds. Actually, Rigpa Rinpoche, when he was dying, he was a great, he died in late 90s? I think it was late 90s. He used to teach in California. That's where I used to live. And so when he died, someone asked him, you know, Rinpoche, what are you... He was dying of cancer. And it was a very long, you know, excruciating process, pain. And so, and he said that... he himself said that he couldn't do any of his practices because the pain was so great. The only thing he could do was have the Buddha's image in his mind. That's the only practice he could do. And even someone like that, right? So that's what he did. He just basically brought the image of the Buddha in his mind, and that's all. That's the way he died. And so, you know, if it works for him, then I can certainly, you know, that's certainly a great recommendation for us, right? So, anyway, so that's the other thing they say, is to practice that if we can. Anyway, that's all I had to talk about today. Did anybody have any questions or yes? Or any other guru yoga that you, yeah, it's fine. Or any other practice that you have, yeah, you can do that. If Tara is your practice, or you know, it, you know, but it's good to, you know, yeah. But I'm assuming when you do Tara practice that it's kind of in the same, it's in the same guru yoga form, right? Not just the mantras, but I'm assuming that you're doing the full practice. Yeah, if you're doing the full practice, then that's a guru yoga practice. Sure. Yeah, you can change. You can choose different deities or choose different Buddhas, you know, the practice of different Buddhas. And I mean, we have that flexibility. I mean, after the thing is that if we've been doing it for a while, we get to know ourselves, and we can kind of change things around. Because if you do the same thing every day, it becomes boring. You know, so. You know, I'll do different visualizations some days because, you know, or I'll do something a little bit longer, some part of it a little bit longer than the other part, or you know, I'll change things and I'll do a different reading, you know, than the one that I was doing. Or some days I will do a different practice altogether, you know. But, you know, but one kind of knows what to do, you know, and one kind of knows that it's okay, you know. Because a lot of times when you're starting out, you wonder, oh, well, am I doing the right thing, you know, right? But then we have this, once we've been doing it for a while, we have this sense of confidence, you know, that we're doing the right thing. Like that.
Spend like a year or some period of time to develop that concentration and switch.
Well, right. So, I will say, okay. So, one doesn't develop calm abiding in isolation, right? In other words, to develop, it all kind of goes together, right? So, if you want to develop calm abiding, by the way, is the, you know, if you have developed, when they say you've developed calm abiding, that means that one can has the capacity to stay on an object, you know, if it's the breath or if it's the topic of refuge or whatever it is, right? To stay on the object effortlessly for as long as one likes, right? So the minute you go into the meditation, you're there. You don't have to think. You're there. And you can, there's never any distractions. You're not, mind doesn't wander. You're single focused on that meditation. That's it, right? It's an incredibly high and powerful ability. Very few people have that. Well, I shouldn't say that, but not very many people have that ability. So it's certainly something worthwhile to strive for, but it doesn't, you know, one can't develop it without having, for example, developed some understanding of Prashant Shuma Reba, all the Lamrim things. So it kind of goes together, right? So you can't just say, well, I'm going to develop calm abiding and then I'm going to come back and do the Lamrim stuff. You kind of, even at calm abiding meditations, a lot of time, well, in the beginning stages of calm abiding, when one is, let's say, going away for, it takes, you know, probably 6 months to a year, you go away and you try to just, that's all you do all day, right? And you're in solitary, you know, you're in solitary retreat. So if you're doing that, then in the beginning stage, you probably still have to do all the preparatory practices, you know, of all the Lamrim, you know, have to do all your 100,000 Vajrasattvas, you have to do 100, you know, all these other things that you have to do to prepare yourself so you can get the blessings, to sow the seed, you know, so the seed can ripen, right? That whole thing. To be having a successful calm abiding meditation. So one still has to do all these other things, right? And then one kind of concentrates on that, goes off, develops that incredible mind, and then one can say, well, okay, now I'm going to go back to the Lamrim and I'm going to make even more progress, even faster progress. So one can do that. But what I'm trying to say is you still have to develop a certain amount of understanding and realization of all the other things. So there's no fast way like that. You know, I mean, we still have to develop the Lamrim realizations to some degree before we can develop calm abiding. But calm abiding, certainly, once we develop calm abiding, the Lamrim and emptiness and bodhicitta just, I only know this by hearsay, right? Or not hearsay, but I know this, I haven't developed it, right? So I only know this from people who have. And so they say that it just happens, it's like a rocket, they said. It's like a rocket. You know, it just kind of it reaches escape velocity and there's no stopping you. So like that. Anything else? Okay, so we'll end with a dedication. So, before we end, I will just make a quick spiel, which is that, you know, all of the teachings here are on donation basis. So, and generosity is one of the central tenets of Buddhism, right? And so if you're able to, in any form or fashion, any donation would be greatly appreciated. It doesn't come to me. It doesn't go to any of the other teachers. But it supports the Dharma, which is one of the greatest forms of generosity. So, yeah. So let's dedicate. Whatever benefit we have gained, whatever merits we have gained by meditating, by thinking, may it be of benefit not only to ourselves, but to all the other beings around us. May they meet the Dharma. May they become better individuals. May they get liberated. And then may they find the happiness that they're all looking for. Thank you very much.